Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson, feeling a little bit under the weather this week, so you've got the low, sexy voice going. We've got a big show this week. A little bit later, a debate between Michael Knowles on the right and Brian Tyler Cohen on the left. And a little bit after that, you'll hear from the Secretary of Veteran Affairs at a homeless encampment in Los Angeles. But we begin with Katie Porter, the congresswoman from Orange County, who has really become a national figure over the last few years. She's helping to lead the congressional investigation into that big oil spill in Orange County that made national headlines as well. And has raised questions about the future of offshore drilling off the California coast. We talked to her about that. We talked to her about the big infrastructure fight within the Democratic Party, and she had some not so kind things to say about Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. I was kind of surprised by how far she went. So let's begin with our conversation with Congresswoman Porter. Katie Porter is the chair of the House Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee. Congresswoman Porter, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you.
You are tasked with helping to investigate this spill. How does something like this happen?
Well, in this case, the cause has not yet been determined, but we will be conducting a thorough investigation, and the federal investigators are already on site doing that, collecting information, beginning to investigate, and that part of it will take time. We will absolutely hold the responsible party accountable. At the meantime, the focus is really on making sure that we're cleaning up the spill as quickly and as safely as we can. This spill has put our wildlife at risk, our health at risk. It's bad for our economy, obviously. And so there's a lot of focus right now on doing the response. At the same time, I want everyone to be assured that there is going to be accountability for why this happened.
What does accountability look like?
Well, it would depend a little bit on who actually was responsible. And so at this point, that is not determined. I do want everyone to understand that this leak did occur in federal waters. The first several miles off the coast are state waters. Beyond that, federal waters, that's where this leak occurred. And the lease that the oil company was using is a Department of Interior federal lease. That's why there's going to be a federal investigation.
You know, the governor talked about wanting to have offshore drilling end when you were out together at a press conference this week. As you mentioned, a lot of this is in federal waters, which means this is a congressional issue. Do you think that offshore drilling should end? And do you have the votes in Congress right now to make that happen?
I absolutely support banning offshore, new offshore drilling. I've been a supporter of that from the very get-go. We had President Trump who tried to increase and create new drilling off the shores of California. Governor Newsom, along with people like me, very strongly opposed that. But I think we absolutely need to ban offshore drilling, and we need to move toward investing in green energy and cleaner energy. And that is exactly what President Biden's Build Back Better Act does.
Are you concerned, though, in the short term about gas prices? We've seen them sky high in California, and by doing something like that, could you end up with less supply?
Well, offshore drilling in California provides a very, very, very small proportion of the fossil fuels that we use. And as the governor said recently, requests to abandon and close down offshore oil rigs last year to the state of California were more than requests to begin new drilling and continue drilling. So we're already headed in this direction, and California has been a leader for the country in this way. I think we need the federal government to catch up to where California has been. California has not approved any new drilling permits for 50 years. And so that's where the federal government needs to get to. So we're protecting all of our coastline.
Let's talk about infrastructure for a moment. Democrats hope to have a deal by now. Progressives and moderates, though, can't agree on how big a package should be when it comes to infrastructure. Where are we at right now? Can you take us inside your caucus?
Yeah, so right now, the President of the United States is working to bring everyone to the table to pass his agenda, and I support that agenda. I support the infrastructure packages, the investments in rail and airports and ports of, ports for water and transportation, but I also support the workers who do that job, and that means investing in things that will allow our economy to compete globally. I spoke to the president in a small group meeting earlier this week, and one of the things he emphasized that is, unless our country invests in things like paid family leave and childcare, we will not be able to compete going forward. So I think the president is having that negotiation. He's leading it. The House stands ready to pass both the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better Act, which we have put through markup. We've had hearings. We've done the work. We've written the legislation. The holdup right now is two senators, and the president is working tirelessly to get those senators to the point of agreement.
Okay, so those senators you're talking about is Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Kristen Sinema from Arizona. They want a much smaller plan, like a $1 trillion plan. People like Bernie Sanders want $3.5 trillion. Where are you on that divide?
Well, to be clear, the House's bill, the initial plan rolled out was $6 trillion. That now came down to $3.5 trillion, and that is what has passed out of all of the House committees. So I sit on the Natural Resource Committee. This reconciliation bill includes my ending taxpayer welfare for oil and gas companies, which would raise the rate that they pay when they drill on federal public lands. That bill is ready for a vote in the House, but there's no point passing it through the House if it isn't going to get agreement in the Senate. So I support what's in the $3.5 trillion bill. Those are necessary investments in climate, in housing, in childcare, in healthcare. We're trying to get Senators Manchin and Sinema to put on the table what they are willing to vote for. And if they're not willing to meet the needs of our economy or of the American people, they need to say so.
So what's your direct message to them?
Well, I think both of them are having conversations with the president. I think they need to go to their constituents and make clear exactly what they are willing to support and what they want to leave on the cutting table. The president has said that we are building back better, and I'm fighting to make sure that no California family is left behind in this recovery. And so that's why the priorities that are in this package are there, to make sure that we create that strong, stable economy for everyone. So Senators Manchin and Sinema, they don't want to take action on climate. They need to say so. If they're not willing to raise the corporate tax rate so that everybody pays their fair share, we don't have large corporations paying zero in taxes. They need to say that. They're simply hiding behind this kind of big number rather than going through what programs are they willing to support, what initiatives and priorities do they have, and what do they want to allow to continue to be a problem and not address.
It sounds like you're frustrated with them.
Well, I think that we're all in this process of waiting for them to continue to have the negotiations. I think they're negotiating in good faith. I have a lot of confidence in President Biden to continue to lead the way, to use his common sense and his thoughtfulness to get to an agreement. But I think the biggest point for people to know is the House is ready to vote on a reconciliation bill and an infrastructure bill. But we want to make sure that we're not just passing them, that they're actually getting signed into law and that our economy is actually getting the help that it needs. We can't do that alone in the House. Progressives can't do it alone in the House. Moderates can't do it alone in the House. We need the Senate to come along. So, you know, I think the president's doing a good job with that. And Senators Manchin and Sinema need to come to the table with what they're willing to support. This is the president's agenda. It's the agenda the American people elected this president on. And the American people need to have these programs put into law to help them.
Before we let you go, we like to have some fun on this show. So we play a game called Personal Issues. This is where we put 30 seconds up on the clock and get to know you a little bit better. I know you've been so busy with work, but this is some of your favorites outside of work. All right, you ready? So here we go.
Yep.
What is the favorite show that you've binged recently?
Peaky Blinders.
All right. Favorite book you've read recently?
Gosh, Alex, these are hard. Right now I'm reading a really great book called Dear Edward. It's about a survivor of a plane crash. It's a fiction book.
Favorite meal to make for the kids?
Oh, spaghetti.
Best restaurant in Orange County?
Oh, I like Eastboro, a Vietnamese restaurant.
And what's your favorite quote or motto?
Oh, buy the ticket, take the ride.
All right, we are taking the ride. Thank you very much, Congresswoman Katie Porter. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Absolutely. Alex, I read about a book every other day. So
do
favorite book I've read recently, I mean, it's like...
How do you fit that
I'm
in?
More
how
of
do you
a
fit that?
Person.
How do you fit that into? Are you a speed reader? How do you fit that into your day?
I read really, really fast. I mean, as a professor, it's an important skill to becoming a professor.
Yeah.
And I don't watch much TV.
Okay.
So I read a lot at night.
Excellent. All right.
So thank you.
I want to be you when I grow up. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Alex.
It. Bye. Our thanks to Congresswoman Porter. Now to a special Issue Is debate, the first time these two have debated anywhere. This is an Issue Is exclusive. On the left is Brian Tyler Cohen, who has become one of the progressives with the biggest audiences online, big star on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat. He's got a podcast called No Lie with Brian Tyler Cohen, which I'm on all the time. And on the right, Michael Knowles is back. He is one of the hosts on The Daily Wire, works with Ben Shapiro very closely, has a book out called Speechless, works with PragerU, has a podcast with Ted Cruz called The Verdict, which is one of the most popular podcasts of all in the whole country. The two of them are two people that I've always thought of together. Both are about the same age. Both have similar backgrounds, sort of, similar height, similar look. But they disagree on most everything, and I thought it would be interesting to bring them together. So here they are together for the very first time. Welcome to you both.
Well, thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Michael, let's start with you. Your thoughts on the increasing vaccine mandates we're seeing all over the country?
Well, I think that I never thought I'd say Gavin Newsom has an issue right, but I guess on his rejection of the vaccine mandates, I think I would agree with him. And it's because I'm not talking about all vaccines, I'm not talking about all viruses at all times throughout history, but on this specific vaccine for this specific virus, I don't think there's any real argument for it, scientifically, legally, or politically. Because scientifically, the reason for a vaccine mandate would be to protect the public health. Vaccines can do two things. They can protect you, the person who gets it, and they can protect other people from you. But this vaccine, while it might mitigate your risk of hospitalization and death, does not protect you, or prevent you, rather, from contracting the virus or spreading it. Even the CDC admits this. That was in their report at the end of July. So there's no additional public health advantage to issuing a vaccine mandate. On the legal side, even Joe Biden, for instance, has hesitated from a full-on vaccine mandate. He doesn't seem to have the legal authority for that. And politically speaking, let's not forget people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were both suggesting that they wouldn't even take the vaccine just a year ago during the Trump administration. They said that it was rushed and they wouldn't trust a vaccine made under Trump. Now, obviously, the situation is different because they're running the show. But I think a lot of people have objections to the vaccines, whether it's for religious purposes, whether it's because they're not at a particularly high risk from the coronavirus, and because there are actual risks from the vaccines, which the CDC and the FDA have acknowledged. People have died in rare cases. So I just don't think on any of those fronts, there's a good argument for the mandate, and I think people ought to use their own prudence.
Brian, what's the argument for the mandate?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're living in the same country, because we've lost 700,000 Americans so far, and the vaccine protects people in 99% of those cases. You know, you are 11 times more likely to die if you are not vaccinated, and the states with higher vaccination rates have less cases, less hospitalizations, and less deaths. Beyond that, you can also consider the fact that the more people who get this virus, the more opportunity it has to mutate. So by willfully allowing it to spread by virtue of not enacting vaccine mandates, we're risking rendering the vaccines that we do have useless and then being right back at the place we started in the very beginning. And,
but Brian,
a political party, that claims to hate this pandemic so much, they seem pretty hell-bent on prolonging it as long as they can.
But Brian, I think the part that you're missing here is that the vaccine does not prevent people from contracting the virus or transmitting it. That's what the CDC acknowledged. That's why the CDC is encouraging people who already got the vaccine to continue to wear the masks. We can debate masks later, but the point is this. This is not merely a virus that is spreading among the unvaccinated. It's spreading among the vaccinated, too. So the points that you're making on people contracting and spreading the virus, or the virus mutating, doesn't matter if you're vaccinated or not. I think you're making a very good argument for some people who are at great risk of the virus to get the vaccine. And I'm not saying they shouldn't get the vaccine. I'm just pointing out that as a public health measure, the vaccine mandates aren't going to solve any of those problems that you're pointing out.
That's willfully ignoring the fact that the rate of breakthrough cases is astronomically smaller than if people aren't vaccinated in the first place. So we can pretend that the vaccines don't help, but again, the rate of breakthrough cases is a fraction of what it is for people who aren't vaccinated.
Michael, you just said, though, that it could very well make it harder for you to die from COVID. Isn't that reason enough?
Well, I think you're making a good argument to get the vaccine, but I didn't realize we were debating whether or not people should get the vaccine. I think that's a completely separate issue. The question is, does the government have the right to institute these kinds of mandates? And I think the legal grounding is pretty shaky. But two, is there a public health benefit to getting that vaccine? And again, I'm just relying on the data here from the CDC that came out at the end of July on the rates of transmission among vaccinated people. But there are reasons not to get vaccinated as well. UC Davis had a study come out not that long ago which showed that for certain young men, they actually face greater risk from the vaccine than they do of dying from the virus. We know that young women in particular have contracted blood clots from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That's why they paused the vaccine. We know that there are rates of myocarditis and pericarditis in people with the mRNA vaccines. We know that the vaccines have caused, again, in rare cases, nerve damage. And we know that people have religious objections to it as well, because all of the vaccines for coronavirus were at least developed, if not also produced, with fetal stem cells. So I just think there are a lot of arguments for prudence here. And also, let's not forget, the infection fatality rate from coronavirus is extraordinarily low. For people under 65, the infection fatality rate is less than half a percentage point. So if you're looking at, for all of these people, 99.5% are going to survive it. And for young people in particular, it's 99.997 or 99.999%. I just don't see where the urgency is for such an extraordinary draconian mandate.
Brian, you know,
the craziest thing here is this is being said as if we haven't, again, just lost 700,000 people. Try telling the families of those 700,000 victims that we just that it's not important enough to impose draconian measures. You know, this is going to be
Age of a COVID death in the United States?
I'm not sure. I don't have that on me.
So the average age of a COVID death in the United States is north of 80. The average age of a COVID death in the United States is higher than the average life expectancy in the United States. So I'm not saying that we don't need to protect grandma. We should, but grandma can go get the vaccine, and that vaccine is going to protect her from hospitalization and death. It's actually not going to provide an additional public health advantage.
I can't speak to the accuracy of those numbers, but even if I do take you at your word, that still doesn't account for the fact that we have younger people who are dying. And how many young people are you willing to expend? Are you willing to allow to die before you're willing to take any stronger measures?
But Brian,
You know, this is going to be the deadliest mass casualty event in American history. More Americans are going to die from this virus than in the Civil War. And virtually all of those dying are unvaccinated. This vaccine is FDA approved, it's free, it's readily available, it's effective, it has been administered to billions of people, and it saved lives. And the deaths that have occurred since the vaccine's been available have largely been avoidable, preventable, if only they'd been vaccinated. So again, to allow for these people to be sacrificed, when we have the data right in front of us, that more than 99% of people are surviving who've been vaccinated, is just an outrageous position, especially for a party that likens itself pro-life.
But Brian, you're making a refutation of an argument that I myself am not making. I'm not saying that people should not go get the vaccine. We're debating the efficacy of the vaccine mandates. And the central claim, it seems to me, that you're making is that by requiring everyone to go get the vaccine, that this will stop the contraction and transmission of coronavirus. But the CDC says that that isn't true. So I think if we're going to debate the vaccine mandate, we need to stay focused on that issue. And so far, you haven't made a single argument as to what the vaccine mandate would do to improve the public health or to stop people from contracting
and
or dying.
Brian, to that point, if the vaccine is so good, why won't people just get it on their own?
I mean, because it's been politicized by right-wing media. You look at the people who are overwhelmingly in the camp of people who aren't getting vaccinated. It's people who've listened to Donald Trump, people who've decided that this is by virtue of people listening to people who've decided that this is more of a culture war issue than a public health issue. But to your point about vaccine mandates, we have other vaccine mandates in this country for measles, mumps, rubella, DTaP, polio, smallpox. There is a reason that we don't have to worry about polio in this country, and it's because we have vaccine mandates. So to challenge the efficacy of vaccine mandates...
We don't have a nationwide polio vaccine mandate.
Well, we do if you want to be a public school student in just about every public school in the country.
certain institutions require certain vaccines, of course, but no one is suggesting that that's not acceptable. But we don't have a nationwide polio vaccine mandate in this country. And furthermore, Brian, to your point that Donald Trump has politicized the vaccines, let's not forget, the vaccines were developed under Donald Trump. He was promoting the vaccines. It was Joe Biden and Kamala Harris who both questioned the safety and efficacy of the vaccines. When they were asked about it last year, they refused to say that they would even get the vaccine because they said they couldn't trust a vaccine made under Donald Trump.
Well, they said
so if we're talking about hesitancy, they were the first people to push it, not the Republicans.
They said that they would get it if Dr. Fauci signed off on it, which, of course, Dr. Fauci has signed off on it. So, Michael, you keep quoting CDC data. You also are quoting CDC data that says that you should wear masks if you're vaccinated. Do you follow that CDC data?
No, I'm happy to quote statistics when they make a good argument for my side. But I also don't think that the CDC is going to be the be-all and end-all authority in the country. You know, one of the issues with the politicization of masks is that at the very beginning of the epidemic, Dr. Fauci infamously said, do not wear masks. The masks will not prevent the spread of the illness. You now have Scott Gottlieb, former head of the FDA, coming out. He just said it in an interview that the separate by 6 feet, the social distancing number, came out of thin air, absolutely. And so there has been a lot of contradiction, not just by the CDC, but also by the FDA, also by the WHO, the World Health Organization, which was instrumental in covering up the coronavirus early on, which led to a far greater spread of it. So I'm happy to take prudential measures. I'm not encouraging people to go out and lick doorknobs or anything like that. But I think it's quite clear. I've already had the coronavirus. I've recovered from it. There is such a thing as natural immunity. Vaccines are extraordinarily widespread. And so I just don't think that we ought to be living in fear and muzzling ourselves, because there are other political considerations and personal considerations to take into account beyond not contracting one single virus.
Well, at least we can all agree that licking doorknobs is a bad thing to do. We're going to have to leave this debate here. But up next, these guys are back to debate President Biden's agenda.
How disappointed are you that there is no vote tonight, Madam Speaker?
Democrats not able to pass President Biden's agenda, at least not yet. He wants to spend trillions on everything from roads to child care. Let's debate this now. Is it worth the price tag? Back for us, Michael Knowles on the right. Let's begin with Brian Tyler Cohen on the left. Brian, why do you support this idea of building back better?
Because I support not being the only country in the world not allowing its government to negotiate lower drug prices for people. I believe that we should expand Medicaid to cover vision, hearing, and dental so that the people who need it most can get it. I support offering paid sick leave like every other industrialized nation in the world. I support addressing climate change, even as storms and wildfires destroy our infrastructure. I think we should modernize the electricity grid. I think we should allow for child and elder care to free up caretakers to go participate in the economy so they can get jobs and stimulate the economy. Not only does all of this make sense, it should be the bare minimum for the most prosperous country in the world, just like it is for every other major industrialized country in the world.
Michael.
Well, I suppose that all sounds very well and good. If I'm opposing this, I suppose I oppose building back better, right? But I think beyond those slogans, which we could all agree on, yes, we all want children to be raised very well, and we all want everyone to be treated equally, and we want to protect the environment. And of course, the question is this the way to do it? This is a bill that is going to cost $3.5 trillion on paper, but it's actually going to cost a lot more than that. Economic analysis has suggested it could be as much as $5.5 trillion, and even the New York Times acknowledges that it's going to cost much, much more than $3.5 trillion. And so beyond all the goodies and the freebies and the very nice things that we all can agree on, let's look at what this law does that is perhaps not so nice and not so popular. You've got a doubling of the size of the IRS and a lot of money being spent to do that. And furthermore, you're giving the IRS in this law the ability to look into your bank account if you have more than $600 in that bank account. So this is a huge expansion of the administrative state and the power of the federal government to look into your affairs. There are a lot of payoffs to public and private sector unions, I suppose, in here. And this is because they're a major constituency of the Democratic Party. And then there's this issue of the debt. I mean, let's not forget the numbers here. It's not the be-all and end-all, but we have a $28 trillion debt in this country right now. Within 10 years, debt-to-GDP ratio is going to be well over 100%. And this is a drag on the economy, and it also raises serious political questions. What kind of a country is it that leaves as an inheritance to the next generation lots and lots of debt? It's a national security problem. It It puts us in a position of weakness and without very much leverage to our greatest geopolitical enemies, notably China. And it's an agenda that's not very popular. I think this is why Joe Biden's approval rating, even according to the very left-wing Quinnipiac poll, is in the 30s right now. It's really, really low, and I think it speaks to the unpopularity of his broader agenda.
Brian, do you think Republicans have consistently been focused on debt?
Yeah, I think starting January 20th, 2021, Republicans have started focusing on the debt. Here's the thing. First of all, this bill is paid for, and it's paid for in ways that are even more popular than the actual provisions of the bill itself. It's paid for by raising taxes on companies that don't pay. It's paid for by raising taxes on the ultra-wealthy, those making over $400,000 a year. It's paid for increasing capital gains taxes on the wealthy. And like Michael said, by increasing IRS funding, because for every dollar spent, the IRS can generate $6 in returns from tax cheats. So for those who oppose this legislation, it really does speak volumes about the kind of people that they're protecting. The fact is that the only reason that Republicans oppose this is because these provisions threaten their entire reason for being in government, which is to coddle the rich. The people who claim that we can't afford these monumentally popular provisions like the ones in the Build Back Better Act are the same people who were frothing at the mouth when Republicans passed a $2 trillion tax cut that overwhelmingly favored the rich. When you spend on the ultra-rich, the deficit doesn't exist, but try to help a teacher or a secretary or a nurse, and suddenly we are Ireland during the Great Famine.
your comment there, Michael.
Well, I think we might have some common ground here, because I have absolutely no problem having wealthy Democrats pay more money in taxes. And let's not forget, the wealthy in this country are disproportionately likely to vote for Democrats, not Republicans, despite a common misconception to the contrary. I have no problem having a giant woke corporations paying more in taxes. That would be fine by me. But what this represents, I think, this Biden agenda, is a power grab. It is a way to spend a lot of money, to entrench power, to increase federal spending as a percentage of the economy pretty significantly, and to this point on the IRS, to give the government a lot more power, not just over the wealthy, who disproportionately actually favor this agenda because they have very good accountants who can get around it anyway, but ordinary Americans, anyone with more than $600 in your bank account, the government's coming to look at your books.
Brian, we know that Speaker Pelosi has called this agenda transformational, but there are some people in the center that might say, you know what, government doesn't do all that much all that well. And this idea of massive programs run by the federal government is concerning.
You know, it's funny that Republicans like to bring this up as boilerplate platitudes, but when you actually look at the provisions in this bill, 2/3 of all Americans support it, and that includes net 78% of Republicans and net 25% of independents, so those very people that you were talking about. So, you know, it's easy to just cast all this off as socialism and communism and big government spending, but we are actually talking about specific provisions that people want, that are popular, expanding Medicaid to cover important provisions like vision, dental, and hearing, universal pre-K, everything that I named before. They are all popular provisions. When we actually get into the nuts and bolts of it,
Brian, if this is so popular, then why is Joe Biden's approval rating in the 30s, according to even left-wing polls? He's losing on every single issue, including on COVID, which, by the way, was the only issue that he was in the positive on. If his agenda is so popular, then how come that's not reflected in his poll numbers?
Michael, could a reason that his approval ratings are low right now is because he hasn't passed the agenda yet? And if he actually was able to pass the agenda, the numbers might go up higher.
Joe Biden has been campaigning on this from day one. And furthermore, he is the executive of the country right now. So while he hasn't passed this $3.5 trillion, really more like $5.5 trillion law, he is executing on his agenda right now on the border, on the economy. Just today, he was bragging about how many people are losing their jobs and there are mass firings, but that's actually good because of public health or something like that. And so I think people are seeing what the agenda is. I don't think what he's passing in this law is radically different from the way he's governing, and it's simply not popular.
Brian, last word to you.
Here's the thing. I think the difference between at least what I do and what the right-wing media ecosystem does is I treat my audience like they're intelligent, because I know that it's not just a matter of Joe Biden trying to pass these things, but him deciding, oh, I'm not going to, that we have a 50-50 majority in the Senate with a filibuster that requires a 60-vote threshold to pass any legislation. So let's not pretend that Joe Biden is choosing willfully
Ryan,
not to pass
it. I know your audience is very intelligent, so I hope they've heard of budget reconciliation. You are aware that the Democrats can get through their agenda with 50 votes plus one. In many cases,
and they're
like
negotiating,
the
and
they're
just
choosing not to do that because they want Republicans and
negotiating
to,
right now.
To own some of their agenda.
And they're negotiating that right now, and something will pass. And by the way, just one more fact, you know, you've called this a $3.5 trillion package. It's funny how
no, I called it a
for Republican priorities
package.
It's funny for Republican priorities, everything is in 1 year increments. But for Democratic priorities, everything is the number over 10 years. The fact is, this is a $350 billion package over the course of 1 year. That is half the cost of our annual military budget. And no one asks how we pay for it when we pump $700 billion into the military for contractors and God knows what so that we can enjoy perpetual wars. But God forbid a senior right here at home gets a hearing aid.
Brian, Donald Trump, the last Republican president, ran on bringing the troops home, and he did draw down the troops all over there. In fact, the last president to push for these perpetual wars in all of these countries was the Democrat Barack Obama. And furthermore, in this budget, one of the stranger items in there is a provision called tree equity, and it's a program to spend a lot of money planting trees in poor neighborhoods. I actually have no problem with it. I think that of all the terrible programs here, tree equity is perfectly fine. I like beautiful neighborhoods. But if you're really comparing the urgency of tree equity versus the national security of the United States, I think the priorities might be a little bit jumbled.
Well, and just to end real quickly, just because Donald Trump was in favor of ending foreign wars did not mean he was in favor of lessening the military budget. There still can be a lot of spending on military affairs, even if you're not in war. But anyways.
Peace through strength, you would call it.
All right. We're going to have to end it somewhere. One thing, though, I think you both can agree on is that you both love being dads. So, Michael, here you are with your new son. Congrats on that. What a picture. What a face there. And, Brian,
thank you.
You don't have a human son yet, but your dog, Aston, gets more love than most children on the planet. So mazel right. tov to you on that. Quite a picture right there.
Thank you
both for coming on. That was fun.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Our thanks to Brian and to Michael. That was fun. We end this week with a visit to the West L.A. VA. Which is in one of the nicest neighborhoods in all of the country, but has an encampment of homeless vets that has been there for years. The Secretary of Veteran Affairs, Dennis McDonough, came there along with Mark Tacano, who is the chair of the House Veteran Affairs Committee, and we walked through it with them as they were confronted by homeless vets that live there. Here's our report.
It's not right. People have to live right now.
Veterans speak out directly to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Dennis McDonough, during a tour of a homeless encampment outside the VA in West LA.
I'm out here representing these men that don't deserve this.
This vet can barely speak due to his injuries.
Whatever you can do.
Count on it. I don't want to see him out here yet.
The tents here include American flags to signify those who served. What goes through your mind when you look into those tents? And what do you say to somebody who says, this is completely unacceptable that this is happening here?
I agree that this is completely unacceptable. That's why I'm here.
The secretary joined by Congressman Mark Tacano, chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee.
I'm more optimistic than ever. We're going to see homelessness end.
HUD estimates there are more than 37,000 homeless vets in America, with more than 11,000 of them living in California.
These are my drawings.
Army veteran Stephen Bew has this sign outside his tent. All veterans need to be off the streets.
What's a man, a veteran that saved the lives of Americans, doing on the street like that?
We all need help.
Gulf War vet Kelly Mitchell pitched a tent here a month ago and was astounded to see some of L.A.'s most expensive real estate just feet away.
You got the richest part of L.A. with the poorest part. It never mixes good together. Something's going to happen.
Is there a place to put some of these people? So they're not literally outside here, but on the property?
Well, I think you see some of it right here, in fact. And there are opportunities here throughout.
On this trip, McDonough and Tacano also toured the VA in Loma Linda. McDonough previously served as President Obama's chief of staff. and says President Biden's mission for him is clear.
When you report back to President Biden about what you saw here and what you saw on this trip, what's your message to him?
Exactly what he sent me to do into this job, which is that I'm confident that he believes this is unacceptable. And his charge to me is to fight like hell for every veteran.
Congress is currently considering trillions in spending on so-called human infrastructure. Congressman Takano says that includes more money for vets.
I have personally spoken to the president about this. He is personally committed to making sure that we take care of our veterans.
Help the veterans, because if it weren't for us, there wouldn't be no country.
Our thanks to the secretary and to those vets for sharing their story. Of course, the biggest story of the week is Dodgers versus Giants. And we got to say, go Dodgers, as they face off in the playoffs for the very first time. Thanks for listening to the Issue Is podcast. We'll see you next week, hopefully after the Dodgers have won.